I want to talk this morning about sewing Buddha's robe. This is a practice that I really love, and right now we have a number of people sewing Buddha's robe, and I haven't talked about it in a while. The last couple of times I talked about it, Bonnie, hi. Good morning. The last couple of times I talked about it, I talked about the history and the meaning of the robe. And today I want to talk about it as a metaphor for our lives. So for those of you who aren't familiar with this practice, I'm going to be talking about sewing a raksu. That's this small version of Buddha's robe that was developed in the 18th century Japan, when the monks needed something to wear that was more conducive to doing their work, or when they had to do some work around the monastery, or when they were traveling, and when wearing the big robe didn't make sense for them, they would wear these. So it's a small version of the okesa, which is the big robe that you see Buddhist priests wearing sometimes. And over the years, it became also something that lay people wear sometimes. And they sew it as a part of Zen initiation. We sew it with prescribed methods of sewing and a particular stitch. It's a very particular way of sewing. And we sew in silence. And with every stitch that we take, we say, I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha. And when they finish their raksus, they receive them as part of a Zen initiation ceremony in which they take a vow to live their lives as a bodhisattva, or an awakening being, a being who helps all human beings. And when I talk today, I'm going to use the terms raksu and okesa and robe and Buddha's robe pretty much interchangeably. So there's a line from the Zen poet Ryokan, 18th century Zen poet, that I really like. It goes, oh, that my monk's robes were wide enough to gather up all the suffering people in this floating world. It's a wonderful, very nurturing image. And I think he must have deeply understood the sorrows of people's lives in order to be able to come up with a line like that. It speaks to his heartfelt desire to help ease the suffering of people. And sometimes when I'm here wearing my okesa, my big robe, sometimes when I sit down, it fans out a little bit, and it'll remind me of that line. And I'll think, okay, this sitting is going to be dedicated to easing the suffering of all the people in this floating world. And it's just a wonderful... it's a wonderful intention to start your sitting with. There's another line that is on the front of your bulletins today. It's part of the robe chant that we chant before we put the robes on. And it goes, wrapping ourselves in Buddha's teaching, freeing all beings. And Buddha's teaching, of course, is about relieving suffering. But not just our own suffering, because we cannot separate our own suffering from the suffering of the world. You know, we can't say, well, this is the edge of my suffering. My suffering ends here, and then yours starts about a quarter of an inch past that. You know, we don't exist independently in the universe, and we're so connected in every second of our lives, in every aspect of our lives, that as long as there's suffering or sorrows anywhere on the earth, none of us are apart from it. And because of that, we also each have the capacity to feel great compassion, because that's where compassion comes from. It arises out of our own suffering and the realization that we aren't alone with that, that just as I have this pain and sorrow in my life, so do other people. It may be different from the way I experience it, but we all have it to one degree or another. So the ripples of this stuff are just endless. And of course, we're also not separate from each other's joys. I don't want you getting too bummed out just yet. We're also connected to each other through our joys. So that sounds pretty abstract. So I'm going to take a detour for a minute into shawls and baby afghans. There are a couple of projects that I've known about where people share shawls and baby afghans. One is a project that's run by a group that deals with domestic violence. And along with all of their, you know, their lobbying and their work with victims and their, you know, their advocacy work, they also have a group of volunteers who knit shawls for people, probably mostly women. They knit shawls for women who have either been victims themselves or of domestic violence, or they've lost someone. They've had someone die as a result of domestic violence. So they make them these shawls, and they're given to the women anonymously. And when they get them, they get a note that says, I just brought one sentence of the note. "We hope that as you wear this shawl, you will feel the comfort, love, healing, and hope that we have knit into it." So that's one of the projects. And the other one is there's a church in St. Paul that has a chest of drawers in the back vestibule. And there's a little sign on it that says, please bring donations to help women who are having problem pregnancies. And I really like that term that they use, problem pregnancies. It brings up sort of all the ambiguities of what that means in this particular church. But anyway, you can take baby clothes, maternity clothes, you know, different things for people. And I used to knit baby afghans, so I would take baby afghans over there. And it was very similar to the work that the shawl knitters did. You know, the people who received the shawls reported back that they felt great consolation when they sat wearing these shawls around themselves. You know, they can feel the compassion that went into every stitch. You know, they don't feel, when they hold the shawl around themselves, they don't feel the yarn, but what they feel is the embrace of the people who made them, these people who they've never met, but who they know care about them. And the people who knit the shawls may have no experience whatsoever with this particular kind of suffering, just as the people who knit baby afghans for strangers may not have any idea of what it's like to have those kind of concerns of a pregnancy that some people might consider a problem. But they've had sorrows of their own, they've had suffering of their own, and as they knit, they develop a kind of compassion and a kind of solidarity with the people that they've never met, whose problems may be very different from the ones that they've experienced. And they also, while they're doing it, learn to have a great deal of gratitude for their lives and the things that they haven't had to go through. So for these people who knit shawls and knit afghans and knit other things that they give away like that, the knitting itself becomes a whole lot like the sewing that we do when we sew the rock sew, because I think that they get very, very quiet when they do it. They get really quiet. And when they get quiet, they start thinking about the women who receive them. And then they also, by extension of that, become more aware in their day-to-day lives. You know, when you're riding the bus and you see people who are just really struggling, they become more aware of those people. They become more sort of connected to them and tuned into them. And they also start noticing more the people who are supporting other people every day in the difficulties and the troubles and the choices that we have in our lives. So I imagine for the people who receive the shawls and the baby afghans that it's something that's very nice. You know, it's a comforting item and it's a nice homemade item. But for the people who make them, I think it becomes a spiritual practice. It becomes a spiritual practice. It becomes sort of a doorway into the metta practices or the loving kindness teachings, whether they're a Buddhist or not. And in both cases, the shawls and the afghans, actually become a robe that's, you know, wide enough to comfort the people in this floating world. And they also help the knitters to wrap themselves in Buddha's teaching. So you're getting both sides of it there. I want to read something from Francis Cook, Huayan Buddhism. We used this book several years ago in study group, and I really liked it. He says, primarily Buddhism is praxis, something that one does. To be a Buddhist entails much more than having a certain philosophy of existence. One must make the philosophy a lived reality. Otherwise, the believer is merely indulging in intellectual fun. The journey itself is a series of acts of a certain kind, including some glimpse, however partial and imperfect, of the light itself. So that's what we're doing here. And when we sew the raksus, we start off with a piece of cloth like this. It's 48 inches by 15 inches. And the first thing we do is that we mark it up, and then we cut it into 17 smaller pieces. They're all different sizes and different shapes. I like to tell people that it's very Zen. We take a big piece of material, and then we cut it up into lots of small pieces, and then we sew it back together into a big piece of material. But so we start off with this cloth, and we cut it into 17 pieces, and there's nothing left over. You know, there's no scraps when you're done. We use the whole cloth. And, you know, you get these 17 pieces of cloth, and you cannot imagine that they're ever going to fit together into something like this. You just, you know, you look at them and you can't imagine it. You certainly can't imagine it transforming into Buddha's robe. But that's what we do step by step for 3 months, Wednesday nights, Sunday mornings. We transform those scraps into the cloth of Buddha's robe. And as I've helped teach this over the years, I see more and more how doing this is just like our lives. You know, there are aspects of our lives that we just can't imagine are going to get transformed into liberation. You know, our doubts and our insecurities and the ways that we don't measure up. The parts of us that maybe we don't share with our friends at Zen Center. And we don't see that we have the potential to become a bodhisattva, that we have the potential to become a Buddha. We don't see that we're already wearing the robe, but we are. But that's what we do. You know, just in the same way as we sew the Rock Sioux, we just keep going. You know, we put those pieces, those scraps of our lives together, and we patch them together, and eventually Buddha's robe starts to appear. And improbably enough, at some point, our life begins to look like Buddha's robe. It might not always look so pretty when we're putting it together. And we may have to take out a few stitches, as anybody who's ever sewn one of these will tell you. You may have to take out a few stitches here and there and drop back and start over. But eventually, these sewn together pieces become an extension of our vow, an extension of our intention to become a bodhisattva. E.L. Doctorow, the author, had a wonderful quote. He once said that writing a novel is like driving at night with the headlights on. You can only see a little ways in front of you, but you can make the whole journey like that. And it's the same thing when we're sewing a Rock Sioux. Usually, we don't know what the next step is coming up. And you can look in the book, and you still won't know what the next step coming up is. At least I couldn't. So when we're sewing the Rock Sioux, we just focus on what we're doing right now. Right now. Right now. It's a lot like Zazen. We just stay right here, right here, right here. And we tend not to look up. And we tend not to try to figure out what the next step is, but we concentrate on the one that we're on. So I think it's the same as any spiritual practice that we have. You know, we don't look up; we just kind of keep going. We just kind of keep walking along. There's an analogy of Dharma rain that a spiritual practice is like walking in a really light mist, and you don't feel like you're getting wet at all. But after you've been out there walking for a while, you find out that you're soaked, and you didn't know it until at some point later when you turn around and see it, and you go, "When did that happen? When did this turn into a robe?" The first night of our class, Tomoe Katagiri, our sewing teacher, has us do a ceremony in which I take all the original pieces and hold them over a piece of incense up here on the altar and go like this. And then when we get done with that, she says, "Now it's been transformed from cloth into Buddha's robe." And of course it was Buddha's robe all along. And even after it's Buddha's robe, it's still cloth. When I buy it at the Joanne Fabric, you know, they used to be made out of rags, but now I buy them at Joanne Fabric. The idea is that you're not supposed to become attached to the fabric. You know, you're not supposed to become attached to the color of it. You're not supposed to become attached to the feel of it. So they used to make them out of rags, but now what we do instead is buy them all in one big piece at Joanne Fabric, and it's cotton polyester. So it's the modern day version of something that we cannot become attached to. So anyway, so they become Buddha's robe, and at the same time as we start cutting it up, you know, when it was on the bolt at Joanne's, it had some value. You know, you go and you pay for it, and it had a value in the world. And then the minute we cut it up, it loses all its value in the outside world. It doesn't mean anything to anybody other than somebody who's sewing on it. It doesn't appear to have any value at all. Shahaku Okamura likes to say, it's good for nothing. He says, our practice is good for nothing. And it's the same thing with this material. After you cut it up, it's good for nothing. So you may as well just keep sewing on your robe. the centerpiece of the Raksu, and also of the Okesa, the center part of it, is called the Kagami. And Kagami means mirror. At San Francisco and Berkeley Zen Center, they call this the face of the Raksu. But I like the translation better of this is the mirror. I tell people it's the mirror of their practice. And it's got long and short pieces that are sewn together in it. And Tomoy told me one time that those represent wisdom and delusion. And then she kind of laughed and said, fortunately, there's more wisdom than delusion in there. And some days I think that's true. The pattern of it is designed to be reminiscent of a rice field. And there's a lot I could say about the rice field. It's another line in the robe chant. Formless field far beyond form and emptiness. It's a rice field. It's the center of our Raksu. And it's also a formless field that we sit right down in the center of when we're doing our zazen, when we're living our lives, especially in the hard parts of our lives. We learn how to sit right down in the middle of that rice field and cultivate that wisdom and that compassion. And we sit with our patched together little lives and our patched together little robes, but we sit as whole cloth that includes everything. Cook says, this training in insight and compassion to which he commits himself, to which the bodhisattva commits himself or herself, this training in insight and compassion to which he commits himself is itself the very life activity of a Buddha. Now you notice he doesn't say that the insight and compassion are the light activity of the Buddha. He says it's the training in insight and compassion that's the life activity of the Buddha. It's not the being there. It's the training. It's the aspiration. It's the intention. It's the over and over again, sort of picking ourselves up and pulling out the stitches and starting over again. That's the life activity of the Buddha. And that is, it's the third noble truth. You know, it's the good news part of the Four Noble Truths. There's a way out of our predicament. You know, there's a way to end our suffering. It takes a little bit of faith at the outset, I think, and it takes a great intention. It takes a vow, I think, to keep us going sometimes. It's just like, I used to have a teacher who said, your life is exactly zazen, or he would say, eating oryoki is exactly zazen. All right, enough with the exactly zazen, all right. But years later, I got what he meant. Sewing the robe and our lives are exactly like zazen in that when we do zazen, we sit down and we breathe. And we stay quiet, and we pay attention. We pay close attention to what's going on, but in a really light kind of way. And when thoughts and feelings come up, as they always do, as they always will, we become better able to remain present with whatever arises. We develop the ability to stay upright with whatever emotions and whatever thoughts come up, and we don't become so determined by them. You know, we don't. We start seeing how that's all they are, is thoughts and emotions. We learn how to keep our hearts and our minds open, even when we're in the middle of some really difficult emotion or some really distracting emotion or some really wonderful idea about what I'm going to do when I get up off the cushion. And we learn how to do that on the cushion. That's our practice. And then we have the harder practice of taking that up off the cushion into our lives. So one of the things that I really like about Kinhin, about walking meditation, particularly for people who are just starting, often say that they find walking meditation to be really hard. You know, it's one thing to do this practice while you're sitting on your cushion, but then you have to get up and walk around and keep your mind right here. So it's sort of a good bridge between Zazen and your life. And then there's walking around Lake Calhoun, you know, meditation, where we're paying attention to the lake when we walk around the lake. Then there's driving your car meditation. Then there's getting in the line that turns out to be the longest line at the grocery store meditation. And if we can learn how to be this way in the world, pay this kind of attention in the world while we're on our cushion, it's got ripples that go out into the rest of our lives. And eventually we're in that same upright mind when we're out in the world too. So sewing practice is also a meditation. And with every stitch of the sewing, we're doing Zazen. So it's a transformative practice. I think any spiritual practice can be transformative, but I have found sewing to be particularly that way for me. And I think that's what I want to say about sewing practice this morning. Yeah, so I see some Roxu wearers and some Roxu sewers out there. Is there anything anybody actually wants to say? Yes, Kate.
We started talking about this the other day and we didn't finish, but a few weeks ago you were not here on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And someone came to me and to ask me for a little bit of help. And I noticed that we talked about the stitching and, you know, was too close together and that kind of thing. And we talked about, you know, do you rip those out or do you go ahead? And there's sort of a conversation about the fact that I kind of feel like this is a document of our experience, in a way, which kind of goes back to the mirror thing, where it's like, you know, sometimes if I feel like it, I will tear out some stitches if I feel like they're, because I'm kind of a fast sewer, I can be a little more indulgent with that. But sometimes if I feel like, especially if I feel like I'm starting to, like, drift in a particular direction, like I'm drifting towards my stitches being too close together, too far apart, then I'll go back. But if I look back and I realize that there's a little space there where they're too far apart, I've kind of gotten to the point where I'm like, I'm okay with that because I've sort of accepted this as a document of my experience, a mirror of my experience, not just something that I have to make perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's the tearing out the stitches where you learn the most from sewing Roxu's. And, you know, Tomoe has said at the beginning of sewing classes before that that we are all going to learn from her and she's going to learn from us. And I used to think that was just kind of a polite thing to say. But I found out that it's actually true that every time, I think I've helped teach sewing, I don't know, it's every other year, so probably about 7 times or something. And every single time, I learn something from the people who are sewing. And I'm also so moved by them, particularly by the people who have trouble with it. Because I've seen people who have never sewn a stitch in their lives, who have to rip out again and again and again and again. And they are almost always so good about it, you know, just, oh, it needs to come out, okay, and then it just comes out. It's really helped me in my life when when there are things that I know that I need to stop and do better or do again, or things that aren't going quite the way that I want them to, you know, it's a really good kind of physical way to practice just taking that breath and going, all right, this is my life. Let's do it right. Yeah. It's also, I had a girlfriend who helped teach this for a while, and she was really a great teacher. She was a better sewer than I was. She was way better at doing the folding and things than I was. But the thing that I really admired about her was that she had such patience for, you know, the step-by-step showing people how to do the work. And I thought, you know, I will never have that. I'll never be able to have that kind of patience with people. And I kind of thought, well, that's really, you know, kind of a shame. But what I found out was that eventually, you know, I stuck with it. And that patience just kind of developed somehow. Where did that come from? So you start to realize that it isn't that I'm an impatient person and that's a patient person, that these are all things that we can develop, you know. I'm an ungenerous person and that's a generous person. I'm a person who doesn't have compassion, you know. Those are just more of those thoughts that come up in Zazen that turn out to be just more training that we need to develop. So anyway, what else? Yeah.
I've noticed, I've always kind of wondered, there's a whole pattern of stitches right in the back.
Yeah.
Does that signify anything?
Yeah, it's a pine needle stitch. And it's got a significance that has just this moment flown right out of my head. I know it's different for Rinzai than Soto. They do kind of a star or a triangle kind of pattern. And probably about 15 minutes from now, I'll remember what the pine needle stitch means. But it's what holds this thing onto the back. It's what holds the manicky on. It's the only way that it stays on is by the pine needle stitch. And it's the same on both sides. There's no ratty looking back to it, like the back of an embroidered dish towel or something.
Okay.
You were talking about the separation between one's own suffering and the suffering of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's always a challenge to cope with that separation or that apparent separation out in the real world. The other week I was driving through Wisconsin. And I stopped off at a gas station to get some gas and eat my lunch. So I parked my car, and I was walking around, and I parked next to this kind of I would call it a modest muscle car. It wasn't
a modest muscle
car. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't a really high-powered one, but that was kind of the niche I would put it in.
Yeah.
And it had a bumper sticker, and so I walked up to check out the bumper sticker, and the bumper sticker said, "I don't believe the liberal media." Okay. Well, then I walked around a little bit more, reflecting on what the owner of that car probably thought and felt about the world. And there was another little sticker on the side of the car which said, "Protect the pre-born."
Mm-hmm.
So these are all, I mean, to me, these kinds of slogans, bumper stickers, sentiments, bring up an automatic reaction against what that person's perspective is.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess just now, when you were talking about, and I should say that, so I was reflecting on who the driver of that car was, and I was trying to put myself in a compassionate frame of mind and thinking, oh, what terrible things happened to you in your life that caused you to think this way? And then I started to think about this question of the pre-born. Well, there is a being there. And I had lost sight of that, I think, in the context of this heated debate about abortion rights and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was good to realize that, I guess, and your talk helped hold that together.
Mm. Oh, good. You know, when I was in my 30s, I remember having talking with somebody about, when did you realize that you were a grown-up? When did you realize that you were an adult? And, you know, baby boomers are sort of famous for, you know, this not happening until way later in their developmental process than their parents did. And the thing that I came up with at that time was when I had felt... when I had an experience that showed me deep, deep pain and sorrow, you know. And because at that time, that's when I realized that everybody has great sorrow in their lives, you know, and yours may be different than mine, but that because I had felt this great sorrow when I met other people, for a while there, I would think, what's yours? What's yours? What's yours? You know, and I would see people as people who are carrying around these stories and this sadness. And later on, I realized that it's not so much when we feel great sorrow as the important point in there was the interconnection. When we can start to see that through our sorrows and through our joys and through our bumper stickers and our deeply held beliefs, that's how we understand that interconnection, you know, when I see a bumper sticker, particularly for one that kind of makes my hair stand on end momentarily, I go straight from that to the beliefs that I have that would probably make that person's hair stand on end. And we come together in that. You know, there's a coming together in that. In those deeply, deeply held beliefs. And those joys and those sufferings. It's a place where we can see that myself doesn't end at my skin, you know? We can see those connections. And I think now I would say that's my definition of being an adult. When you can make that kind of connection. Somebody asked me one time, what's different now that you're a Buddhist? I said, I have no idea. I have no idea because... but there is something about being an adult, I think. Yes, Will.
When I imagine myself still in the rocket suit, I find myself... counting the rows I've done, how many rows left to go, and that last stitch, finally it's done.
Yeah.
So what would you say to someone like me if I was like
that? Ah. Well, in case you didn't hear it, he said that when he imagines himself sewing a rock suit, he imagines thinking about that last stitch, and oh, now I'll finally be done. And when I was sewing my priest robe, my Okesa, the first one, I was sewing it with several other people, and one of them was coming up to her last stitch in the Okesa, and she asked Tomoy, "So, is there anything special about the last stitch? Is there any kind of special, you know, gata that we say, or is it, you know, I don't know what she was expecting?" But Tomoy said, "The last stitch is exactly the same as the first stitch. It's exactly the same." I think, Marty, when you and Ben were sewing, didn't Ben calculate how many stitches there were in an Okesa? Yeah. It was an infinite, yeah, it was like the Okesa version of a Kalpa, right? Yeah. Every so often, I think I'd like to ask him how many stitches that was, and then I kind of don't want to know. So,
18,000.
Yeah.
It was a frightening large number that freaked us all out.
Yeah.
There really is only one stitch.
And then there's one stitch. That's right. So. All right. Thank you. Oh, there's a question over here. Yeah. Oh, with a rock suit. Hello.
I was wondering about the spaces in which we wear the rock suit or we don't.
Mm-hmm.
Because it says that the genesis of it as an object was for traveling or doing work.
Mm-hmm.
It crosses sort of the inside outside of the temple of the tree, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
In America, different training centers, it seems that most people wear it in the training center, but not outside of it.
Yeah.
Well, when they're sitting outside, they put them and take it off afterwards.
Uh-huh.
That's what maybe you could talk about that.
About when, he's asking about when we wear the raksu, you know, inside the training center, outside the training center, when we're sitting, when we're working around here. And I think, generally speaking, we wear it when we're in the training center, and at times when we're outside the training center, when it is something that will bring us closer to the people that we're with. You know, sometimes it pushes you further away from the people that you're with. I don't like wearing my large Okesa, for example, when I'm out in public. One time I went to a hospital for a service, and I had put on my Okesa, and then someone said, oh, you need to go get so-and-so. And they were, you know, up 4 elevator flights and over and around. And so I had to walk all around this hospital wearing an Okesa. And I felt like it made me the other. It separated me from the other people on the elevator. So I think that wasn't a good time to wear it. But times when I do wear it, when I go out somewhere to teach, you know, if I go to a school or a college or something, I'll wear it there. During Rahatsu, if I go out for walking meditation, I'll wear it out there under my coat. But typically not too much outside the Zen Center. Yeah, Kate?
I was just reading something about this in that little John Dagalori book about Zen
ritual. Yeah.
And then there's a question in the book. Someone says, we're taught that that everything is the same, and that we're all people who defecate and vomit and bleed and whatever. And, you know, there's nothing separate, there's nothing special or unspecial about anything.
Right.
And yet, when we go to the bathroom, we take off our raksu and we rinse carefully full. Why is that? And he. So there's some quote about when you're cold, burn the Buddha.
Mm.
You know, the idea of there's nothing sacred about this wooden Buddha if you're cold, burn the Buddha. But he said that was a reminder for people who needed to bring let me make sure I get this right, but whose lives were very much all about the sacred and remembering to bring the every day the sacred, and we remember to bring the sacred every day. And when if our lives turn around, then we could bring the Buddha. Then we could wear the rock suit to garden.
Mm.
Then we could be. But we need the reminder of something being. We need the reminder that direction, and they needed the reminder the other direction. Them, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't remember. I mean, he worded it well, but but that, you know, we're looking at the, we're on the wrong side of the looking glass to burn fluid
right now.
Yeah.
There's a story about Suzuki saying to his students that, how did this go? That he had to talk to them about emptiness because they were all stuck in samsara. And then when he saw them becoming stuck in emptiness, then he had to talk to them about samsara to kind of bring them back into emptiness. But, you know, we have to be careful that, you know, it's a robe, and in some senses, you know, it's a sacred item, but we also have to be really careful not to let it be something that divides us, something that turns some people into a brown rock soup person and somebody else into a blue rock soup person and somebody else into a black rock soup person and someone else into, you know, a person who for some reason doesn't have a rock soup on. And I think that's a particular, I don't know if it's a problem in other places, but it's something that I worry about a little bit in this country with our fascination for defining ourselves individually. Sometimes I think when we sew these rakasus, it would be a very good idea each time you sew a little piece of it to go put that in a pile on a center table. And then everybody do that. And then when you need the next piece, you go pull a piece off of that center pile so that we all end up with pieces of each other's rakasus and we can't quite get so attached to our own stitches. And then they all become sort of a piece of the universal rakasu. But that's not our... I can hear Timoy say this in my head as I say that. That is not our practice. So, yeah.
Bye. I have a little story about Roberta, actually. But I won't mention her name.
Okay.
This is one of... in response to when you wear the rakasu, she's one of Katagiri Dharma heirs, and she has a center in Carolina. And... she was raised Catholic, and we used to wear a scapula. A blessed little thing that had a picture of Christ with something on the front, and then two like strings together, and then something on the back, and you wore it inside your clothing, and you had all your clothing over that. And so what Roberta would do when she made her rakasu is she wore it inside her clothing. And she wore it all the time. And it absolutely shredded. And she had to do another one. And she went through quite a few of them because she wore it all day, every day, close to her. And she said that just really reminded her all the time of her vow. And that was beautiful. And I noticed the contrast. I felt mine was so precious. You know, I never want to wear it out. So
yeah.
You can wear it in many ways.
Thank you.